Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice. We here at Lady Justice, we here at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. And prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget, in case you can't listen to each show from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, you could always listen on our archival feature at any time, anywhere. Just look for the big red heart with the cracks. Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Saturday. This is Donna, Lady Justice, welcoming you. And as always, I want to also welcome my co-host, Delightful Delilah, as we frequently call her, CEO, CFO, COO of Imagine Publicity Marketing Firm with an emphasis in social media marketing. And even of late, resume consulting. So, Delilah, it's always a pleasure to have you. Welcome aboard. Thanks for helping me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me again another week. And it's so fun because every week you give me a new title. I feel so important.
Well, you know, I got to keep those creative juices going, Delilah. So we try. Yes, and it's always fun. And although I have to say, although we deal with shattered lives, as our title says, we try to be educational. We try to have fun and some informality here because that's what it's about. And even though I come from the background of shattered lives in more than one aspect besides crime, it's always been my philosophy that we have to look at life as being the glass is half full, and that's what I try to do, and I try to have an upbeat personality, and hopefully people are getting that, and they know that I'm respectful to the issues. But before I have our very esteemed guest come on today, I just want to mention very briefly something else that's very important, particularly this time of year, and someone else that is part and parcel of Imagine Publicity, and she reminded me of this yesterday, is Susan Murphy Milano, an intimate partner, violence expert, and the author and creator of the EAA, Evidentiary Abuse Affidavit. And that, you know, during this time of year, people are enjoying outdoors, the weather is, you know, just all out of proportions, a lot of times tempers flare, and that only adds fuel to the fire if you're dealing with a volatile domestic situation. So I really, really encourage people to go to SusanMurphyMilano.com or DocumentTheAbuse.com and Delilah's website, and you can learn about this. I mean, it's all about documenting what's gone on previously and making a safety plan and documenting things in such a way as so things don't get thrown out of court, which wasn't the case before. So please, please do go and utilize these resources. It's so important. And yesterday I had a very rewarding experience with respect to that, and we're hoping that it will be promising for other people as well. So please do keep that in mind. Now, to get to the guest at hand this evening, Dwayne Bowers, our esteemed guest, is a licensed professional counselor. He's a clinical hypnotherapist in private practice. He does many different things with respect to consulting, using a holistic approach with many mind, body, and spirit techniques. He deals with people who have been abducted, people that go missing, people dealing with children who are exploited, suicide. So take your pick, anything having to do with trauma. He is technically known as a trauma specialist, and we are so fortunate to have him because I think many, many people deal with tragedy, and they are at loose ends in terms of how to deal with this. So I think we have many questions and a lot of good information to impart. So welcome to Shattered Lives, Dwayne. We're so pleased to have you.
Thank you, Donna, and hi, Delilah. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it is certainly our pleasure. And before I get to, our laundry list of questions here, maybe I'll give you the floor first of all and have you make some general statements with respect to what do you think is most important in terms of doing the kind of work you do and just kind of, a word to the wise for people who are dealing with trauma.
That's a good place to start. Folks who have gone through a traumatic experience, first of all, there is no real definition of what is trauma from a mental health point of view. The only tool we have to work with is something called post-traumatic stress disorder, and there is, of course, a diagnostic criteria for that. But what is trauma is kind of a question that a lot of people don't really even know what would you call trauma. You know, some folks may think that having to go visit the mother-in-law might be traumatic. so you have to first of all recognize that it's not so important what is trauma as what is your reaction to the event. And if your response to the event is that you keep thinking about it, you can't avoid it, it's just everywhere that you go, you're triggered by it. If you're noticing that even when you're trying to avoid it, you're just re-experiencing it all the time, dreams, nightmares, whatever. And if you're hypervigilant, in other words, if you're angry a lot, if you can't sleep, if you notice some changes in your behavior as a result after this event, get some help. There's nothing wrong with going and getting some help. In fact, the sooner you get help, the less you will suffer, and the less your family around you will suffer, and the people who love you will suffer because they see this happening too. And
right.
One of the happens is people fall into self-destructive behaviors very easily after a traumatic event, drinking too much, eating too much, even to the extremes like cutting behavior and pulling of hair and that sort of thing. And it
wow.
starts slow, but then it builds and builds, and before you know it, you have some sort of an addiction as a result
mm-hmm.
of this event. So, you know, the sooner you recognize you have a problem, you can go get help. The less damage you do to yourself, I think.
Right. But I think sometimes those of us that are in that kind of can't see the forest for the trees. And
yes.
frequently an outside source has to say, wait a minute, you know, this is something more than, you know, oh, you're just a little depressed or whatnot, right?
Yes.
I was wondering, Dwayne, how can we be good consumers in terms of shopping for a good counselor, someone that it has the right credentials and experience to deal with what the problem calls for?
What a great question, because people rarely ask that question.
Really?
And, you know, there are therapists out there that just don't know how to deal with trauma, and but won't tell that to the client. So first of all, as a client, as a person looking for a mental health professional, shop. Mental health professionals, I mean, there's an old generation that believes you never question a doctor and you never question a mental health professional, whatever. Yeah, that's not true. Question. Shop. And if you call that doctor or you call that therapist and you're not comfortable with the conversation, move on. Move on to the next one. The therapist should be willing to talk to you by phone before you make an appointment. You need to have a sense of, are you going to be comfortable with this person? And if they won't spend some time talking to you on the phone before making a first appointment, move on. Don't even mess with them.
Are there particular questions other than, well, what's your credentials? Because when you walk in the wall, you can see diplomas hanging on the wall, and they always look impressive. But are there particular questions that maybe they should be asking other than where were you trained and how many years have you been dealing with thus and so?
Absolutely. always kind of describe your situation, whether it's domestic violence, whether it is having experienced sexual abuse, exploitation, whatever it is. State what your situation is, and then say, ask the question, have you dealt with this before, and how many clients have you dealt with this? Because, you know, if you ask me if I've ever dealt with that before and I've had one or two clients, I'll say yes. But then if I tell you I've only had one or two clients, then you start to realize, maybe not. And one thing that I'll always suggest with trauma is if you don't know of a therapist and no one's given you a recommendation, start with a therapist that has been certified in EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Can you say that term again a little bit slower? What was it?
No, I'll run through that real fast again because those are really easy words.
Oh, come on.
I'm sorry.
Hey, we're having fun. It's Saturday. Go ahead.
EMDR is a form of treatment for trauma called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's been around for several years. It's recommended by the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, and it really involves eye movement. It is the idea that if you have images that you're stuck on or a behavior that you're stuck in that you can't seem to get past, that a therapist who is certified in this can, by giving you an eye, they'll either use their fingers perhaps and move them in front of your eyes, or they may have a light machine that does this, and it makes your eyes move right to left, and it causes your brain to process in a certain way. Anyhow, my point is, even if they don't use that modality on you, if they've been trained in EMDR, they've got a pretty good background in trauma. So I'm not saying necessarily to go to them to have the eye movement form of intervention. But if they're trained in EMDR, they've had some pretty good training in trauma, and they get trauma, and so they're a good resource.
I'm a believer in the medical model, having had 55 surgeries, but I imagine if you said eye movement something, people are going to say, what has this got to do with, you know, domestic violence or whatever? How would you respond to that?
I would explain it like this. When things get stuck in our, let me back up even further. Everything that happens to us in our lives, everything that we do, has to be processed across both lobes of the brain. That's the right brain and the left brain, the two hemispheres. Right. And when things get stuck, when you have flashbacks or nightmares, or you get into a compulsive behavior that you can't seem to break, it's not being processed across both lobes of the brain. So one of the things that causes one way that you can get your brain to work is, for example, if you take your left hand and slap your left leg, that activates the right side of your brain. If you do the same thing on the right side, it activates the left side of your brain. So even doing that will cause bilateral processing. So the eye movement, having the eyes move across center, you know where Francine Shapiro got this from. She's the woman who developed EMDR. People in REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, you watch them, their eyes are going back and forth while they're asleep. Well, that means they're actually processing stuff in their brain. And when their eyes go to the left brain's processing. When their eyes go to the right brain's processing. So the idea here is that you bring up that stuck image in your head, and by doing the eye movement, which activates the two sides of the brain, it helps you to process it so that you can file it away and you're not stuck on it anymore.
So you're using visualization and you're manipulating them in terms of the eye movement or monitoring that.
The visualization would be what if they've got an image that they can't process, they bring that, they call that up to mind, or they call up whatever the behavior is, and it helps them to process it. There's a lot of science behind it, and like I said, all of the major mental health associations recommend it for trauma.
Good. So that's just one pointer to have in mind when you're looking for someone with that degree of specialization. And, I think that's good to have. Let's see. I have a multitude of questions here, but I'll ask you a couple and then throw it over to Delilah.
Okay.
As a trauma specialist, what have you learned in dealing with victims of violent crime versus other forms of trauma? Because I met, you know, many of our listeners fit into that category. Are there special things that you have gleaned over the years with regard to if you wanted to separate those populations?
Yeah, there are. And I might want to add, too, that I work with military personnel who have come back from active duty. I also have done a lot of disaster work. I went to Haiti. I was in Kosovo during the Kosovar War, helping people in refugee camps. So I've seen people
right.
in a lot of different kinds of traumatic situations. One of the things that is unique to being the victim of a crime is that, there's a couple of things. Number one, it's purposeful. In other words, the person had intent to hurt you, harm you in some way. And number two, you didn't ask for it. So if you look at a military personnel, they knew they were going to be in a situation that might be traumatic. So that's a difference. Even in like a disaster, like a hurricane or whatever, you may know that it's coming. But in crime, the person has intent to hurt you in some way, and you don't see it coming usually. Usually it's by surprise. And that's what makes a victim of a crime or crime trauma unique, are those two characteristics. There's about 9 characteristics that people tend to look at that kind of determine for them whether the event is going to be traumatic or not. One of them is, did it have a warning? And another is the intentionality. So I think those are the two things, the two characteristics that are probably
different.
Most profound.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What they're different than other types of trauma.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Just very quickly, and then I'll ask Delilah if she'll come in here. In terms of healing, does a victim recover more quickly, do you feel, if the perpetrator is known versus unknown?
Oh, that's a difficult one to say, because it depends on the extent of the trauma.
Yep.
The relationship, there are a lot, you can't really answer
a lot of variables.
That with a general answer. Yeah, there are a lot
okay.
of variables there. So.
Okay, well, that's fine. Great. Delilah, what do you have on your list here?
Well, I think this whole conversation is quite interesting and I think very resourceful for a lot of people out there. And
yeah.
My first question, when... Let's say, for instance, if you have a friend or a family member or someone that you know needs to have some sort of help, but they're very resistant to it, how do you intervene? How would a family member intervene with another one or to a friend or another person? How would you go about that, just being an average person, to get them to someone like you?
Great
sure.
question.
First of all, again, it depends on the relationship. If you're talking about husband or wife, for example, you're probably not going to be able to force them to go, where if you had a child who was suffering from trauma, you can pretty well mandate that they go. But one of the things, you have to just keep making the information available and proving to them that it's relevant. That's the thing. See, the reason I don't go is because I don't think it applies to me. I don't think I need it. And so if you can keep showing me, you know, before the event happened, you didn't beat up the refrigerator like you do now. You know, before the event happened, you didn't lose your temper as much as you do now. Before the event happened,
yeah.
you didn't stay awake all night like you do now.
So point out concrete examples of their change in behavior?
Yes. And the more you can show me, yes, there has been change, and yes, it is affecting me in a negative way. Yes, I stay up all night and I'm starting to get warnings on my job because I fall asleep at work. Aha, now I can start seeing the relevance and I'm much more likely to go. Also, I got to tell you, I'm much more likely to hear it from, like a pastor or a friend or someone like that than I am from my spouse. because I can rationalize and justify, okay, she's got an ulterior motive, he's got an ulterior motive, she just doesn't like the fact that I'm getting angry, da-da-da-da-da. Where if I hear it from a friend that's on the outside, I'm going to listen to that much more. And so what I'm saying is, if you are a family member, go find a best friend of your family member and say, do you see the changes? Can you help me convince him he needs to go for help or she needs to go for help?
Yeah. Well, those are good thoughts, because I think frequently sometimes we're too close to them, and just because of that relationship, they're not going to listen to us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, one of the best ways to get an adult into therapy after a trauma is if the trauma has happened to the whole family.
Yes.
People will usually take their kids to therapy because they want their kids to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them that they also need to go to therapy to learn how to help support their kids.
Yeah, group therapy.
Just suggest to them to go to individual therapy so they learn how to help to support their kids. The ulterior motive is they're going to get some help too. But that's one thing that people will tend to do is, if it's about my kid, I'll go if it's going to help my kid.
Yeah, that's a little sneaky, but it's good. Very, very good, yeah. You know, I know you had told me that there are particular cutting-edge issues these days with respect to trauma victims, and some of the acronyms that you told me about, and something that I'm very interested in, because I think I'm an example of the other acronym, not the PTSD, but the PTSG, standing for growth, correct. My situation, my father was killed in a homicide 31 years ago, and I've been advocating for crime victims all this time in some way or manner or form, sometimes more actively or less actively, and since coming on with Imagine Publicity, it's really become very active. And, you know, isn't that, you were saying, a sign of taking your traumatic situation and doing something for the good? G for good, G for growth?
Yeah. Actually, an acronym is PTG, post-traumatic growth.
No S in there. Okay.
And
sorry.
Basically what post-traumatic growth is, in therapist words, would be the client doing an activity that gives a new meaning and value to the event. Now, you mentioned that I work a lot with parents of missing children or children who are abducted and murdered. One of the things that you find happens is a parent who is in recovery and who is experiencing post-traumatic growth very often will start a nonprofit to help other parents whose children are abducted or murdered. In your case, your post-traumatic growth is in giving your father's death a whole different meaning and value by being an advocate for other victims and helping people have a voice as a victim and learn the resources that are out there for them. What that does is it means that, using you as an example, that your father didn't die in vain, that his death now, as a result of his death, other people have been helped. It has a whole new meaning and a whole new value, and that's what we mean by post-traumatic growth. Now, we can really get
into that. Correct?
Absolutely. It's a sign of resilience, actually. A person has, in order to be able to do that, has to have some resilience. So it's a good indicator of resilience and a good indicator of recovery. Here's one reason why. If you know somebody who is really severely affected by PTSD, by trauma, they're very self-centered, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but everything is about how it affects them. They're very focused on the event and how it affected them. When people can actually start talking about others and how others might feel, that's a good indicator that they're starting to recover, that they're starting to recover from the trauma.
Oh, wow, that's very good. Go ahead, Danila.
I'm sorry, something that I ask a lot of times on different shows, you know, you have two people who come through the similar or maybe even the same circumstance, and you have one person who crawls into a corner in a fetal position and just can't handle it, and then you have the other person, like Donna and others that I know, that kind of get out into the world and really make something different happen for their lives. And
right.
How does that happen? How does one person go one way and one person go another?
It has to do with their resilience, their ability to return to normal functioning after a traumatic event. And there's a lot of controversy in the research right now about resilience as to whether it is learned behavior or whether there's a genetic basis to resilience. And I think what the research is actually kind of showing is there's a little bit of both. How you are raised, if you are raised to be self-confident and being able to be dependent upon yourself and whatever, you might be more likely to be resilient. If you are surrounded by a family who is resilient and something happens to you, you're more likely to be resilient just because it's learned behavior in those cases. And I think they're finding that there may be some genetic disposition to it as well. Though I got to tell you, if you read the trauma journals, and I read two or three of them a month, there's still a lot of controversy about which is it, nurture or nature.
Right.
And you find as much argument one way as you can the other.
Hmm. Do you have a response to or a tip to give to people with regard to the comment, regardless of if it's 6 months down the line or 6 years or in my case 31, you need to move on? I mean, that is an insult to many people because I think they're doing the best they can in many cases, or they're doing something very valuable for other people. And to have someone say that, just essentially forget about it, move on, I don't feel that way.
Right. Again, from a mental health point of view, it would depend on what is your motive for doing the work you're doing. I'm going to use you as an example again.
Go ahead.
So when your father was first killed, your motive was all about, actually, it was all about your own recovery. It was about, if I can help other people, I can make myself feel better. And if I can help other people, then it can change the meaning and value. My hope is that 31 years later, your motive now is, you really have a passion to help other people, and you have a passion to help people get through this kind of situation. So in other words, the motive is not so much about you anymore and about your recovery and about you needing to affect the meaning of your dad's death as it is now. It's a passion for you to help people do this. It happened to guide you into a field that you became very passionate about, and now you're doing it for the work's sake, not for your recovery or not for your father. If that changes,
you are so right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Glenn.
If that has happened, it's very healthy. But if the person 31 years later is still doing it out of their own need, their own emotional need and their own recovery, that's not very healthy. And they probably do need some support still 31 years later.
For sure. Well, that really validates, I think, who I am and why I'm doing what I'm doing. And makes me feel good. Thank you. I'm going to have you on every week.
You're healthy.
I'm healthy. Oh, good. I hope my mom's listening. But anyway. we wish. So in any case, this is wonderful. Can you illuminate for us some of your experiences? I know you worked with survivors from the Pentagon during 9/11, and maybe that would be an interesting aspect to talk about. And we also want to talk a little bit about the retreat that's coming up as well. So take it away.
Well, 9/11 was unique in a lot of ways, and it depended on where you were. And remember that I'm in Washington, D.C., so we had a little different perspective here. One of the things we in D.C. pretty well knew is we were one of the few open capitals in the world, and most people knew that there was a likelihood we would get hit one way or another, but we trusted that our law enforcement and that all of the secret agencies and all would keep us safe. But we knew there was a possibility that if something could happen in D.C., just because we were wide open. So when it hit here, we probably had a different response than folks in New York, where they, why New York? And, of course, thinking in retrospect, of course, hit the World Trade Center. That's a big symbol. Of course hit it. But on some level, I think in this area, we, because all those agencies are here, because you know, the Pentagon is here, and most folks in the D.C. area are government employees, I think it's something that we didn't talk about, we didn't think about, but in the back of our heads, we knew this was a possibility. And so for us, it made it real. And yes, indeed. And, of course, look at what they hid. Understand that terrorism is about making you afraid. It's not so much about the number that they kill, but the number that they make fearful. Well, you hit the Pentagon. My God, that's the center of the protection of the United States. You know, you hit the very building that is supposed to house the people that are going to keep me safe. So what better target in D.C. other than the White House itself or the Capitol itself?
Yeah, how ironic, right?
Yeah,
being vulnerable, yeah.
Yeah, they planned it that way. And again, they made a statement to the world by hitting the World Trade Center and hitting it twice. I mean, you know, hitting it once, I don't know if you, where you were when it happened, but literally when they hit it the first time, I heard it on the radio, so I turned on the TV going, oh, my God, this is an awful accident. And I saw the second plane hit, and I'm like, oh, my God,
it
can't be an accident, you know?
Yeah.
And what a revelation. What a fear.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, so that doesn't in any way, just because I know it might happen, it doesn't reduce the effect that it has on me, but it's not the same kind of surprise that it might have been for the folks in New York. Or let's say they'd hit someplace out in the Midwest. You know, that would have been a real surprise, because why? There's what would be the value of hitting someplace in the Midwest as far as a symbolic gesture? So,
right, and I don't think they anticipated for the plane to go down in that small town in Pennsylvania either.
No, well, that's and from what we have heard, actually what caused that to happen was the passengers. The pilot pilot crashed it, basically. So,
right.
Absolutely, and they were heroes in that it was destined to go to, they think, the Capitol or the White House. So they averted that. But anyhow, so folks coming out of there. Now, one thing you have to understand about 9/11 is this country threw a lot of money at the survivors of 9/11. And Red Cross had a big 9/11 Survivor First Fund, and there was tons of money that people just, we all wanted to help. We all wanted to do something. And since we couldn't personally do something in this country, one way that we help is we send money. So we were fortunate in that there was a lot of money to help the recovery of the families that were affected by 9/11. And actually, that money lasted for almost 7 years. People were still getting support in various ways. And the reason I know this is because after I worked with folks at the Pentagon, I actually provided mental health support to the caseworkers who were distributing the 9/11 Survivors Fund for the next 7 years. Because they were hearing horror stories and all sorts of things, and they needed support. So, so for about 7 years, we had money to help support these families, which is wonderful because you got a three-year-old kid that isn't really grasping anything other than daddy's never coming home again. 7 years later, they're 10. They get it. They understand. Now they need some support to be able to deal with this from this different perspective. So having that money for that period of time was extremely useful for folks. And I didn't mean to get on a soapbox. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No, I think it is very important. And I just wonder, you know, walking in, I mean, you assist people in so many different realms with respect to trauma was, but invariably to me, it seems as if that must have been a whole different category of horrific. You know, it's so at the other extreme. I mean, there you are at the Pentagon, and then in August you're going to be at this nice, serene, comfortable retreat. What, you know, there's a dichotomy there. How do you reconcile that, or can you describe how different those kind of venues are for you as a professional?
As a professional, well, remember I said that I was in Haiti. I was also in Kosovo during the war, helping families families were split up and sent to different refugee camps. There were over 100 camps over there. So we were working to get the families together into one camp. So, yes, I have been in a variety of situations. From my perspective, I'm looking more at what's the pain and suffering of the client.
Mm-hmm.
So, quite honestly, once the camps were set up, let's say, in Kosovo, or actually the ones in Macedonia, folks had a roof, folks had food. They couldn't go back home because the full war was still going on, but they were being taken care of. In Haiti, there was nothing left in the town, but in the tent at the hospital, they were getting food. They had electricity. They had water. In fact, the patients in the tent at the hospital had more infrastructure than the whole city of Port-au-Prince at that point. So even though it sounds negative, you have to look at the larger context. And so what I'm looking at when I'm in those situations isn't so much what context am I in, because I know I'll survive, I can survive taking cold showers because there's no hot water. I can survive, being out in the
Wayne, you are resilient.
Well, but I'm looking more at what is the level of pain. So quite honestly, these folks that I'll be working with in Omaha, if some of them if they're missing loved ones, if it's a relatively new missing, their level of pain may be much, and suffering may be much more intense. I'm not going to say more or less. I'm not trying to make a judgment. I'm just saying more intense for them in this nice environment than perhaps the suffering and pain of someone who is recovering in a tent in Haiti.
Right, because they're used to such chaos and lack of resources and whatnot.
Well, and because they know everything's being done that can be done, where someone with a missing person, they don't know that, and they don't know what's happening to their person, and is their person suffering out there somewhere or whatever. There's a lot of unknown, and the more unknown about the trauma, the more profound it can be for the client. So the setting isn't always the best indicator of suffering. It is the individual clients and what resources are available to them and what level of uncertainty is there. I want to make one more comment on that. Dan Siegel says that your relationship with uncertainty and death will dictate how you live your life, and I really believe that.
Say that once again so we can all process it. Your relationship of what?
Your relationship with uncertainty and death will dictate how you live your life. So if you don't handle uncertainty well, you will live a life that's very structured. If you can deal with uncertainty, then you're going to take risks. You're going to do lots of different things and feed off of that. So all I'm saying is I think it's not so much the environment that you need to look at as far as how that trauma is affecting a person.
Right.
You know, a woman who has watched a domestic violence situation where her husband has beat her up and killed her baby, and she's in the best hospital on earth, just because she's in the best hospital doesn't mean that her trauma is not through the roof, is not as intense as anyone's could possibly be. So
the ability to acclimate to the environment, is a variable, but it's not sort of the end-all, be-all?
Yeah, in fact, in trauma, very often I don't even connect with my environment for the first few days. I know where I am, but I may not even be connecting with the resources that are available to me. I'm not taking a whole lot in. I can't concentrate for long periods of time. You have to repeat things. I'm not thinking clearly, so I might not even be connecting with my immediate environment for the first few hours or days after a trauma.
You're just focusing on the people that you're assisting. Yeah, I've a question regarding sort of the holistic nature of some of the techniques that you use, and then we'll ask Delilah maybe to have ask one of her another question as well. You, it seems as if you appear to incorporate many forms of mind, body, and spiritual therapies. And when you work with a new client, how is it decided which techniques to do? Is there some? Do you like sit down with them and or stand up and create a master plan, as it were, to figure out, you know, what's going to be the most effective for this particular person?
Yes, exactly. And what I do when somebody comes in after a traumatic event is I don't ask them to talk about the event right away, because there's some good indication in research now that going back and reliving the event may not be necessary. I think it is, but not at first. And so
okay.
I won't have them immediately tell the story, because that's one of the things they don't want to do. When they come in, that's one of the reasons people don't come to therapy, is they're afraid that the therapist is going to make them tell the story right away. The first thing I ask is, how is the event affecting you today? What happened today that you know is a direct result of the event? You couldn't leave the house. You didn't want to talk to anybody. You isolated. What happened? How are you noticing that this is having an effect on you? Because you know what? They're not going to trust me until I can prove to them that I have some interventions that will help you function day to day. Once you start functioning better day to day, now let's dig into the event and look at the meaning and value you're giving it, and see if we can change some of those meanings and some of those values and make some of that horror go away for you. But they don't really trust, and I wouldn't either, trust the therapist until you can prove to me that you can help me function. You can help me go to work. You can help me stay focused at work. And if I can use some of these complementary interventions, the mind-body stuff, to help you in that way, then once you trust me a little better and you're functioning a little better, now we can dig into the event and go back and revisit it and start looking at the meaning that you're giving it, and can we start looking at it in a different way? So that's where I start. How is it affecting you? What are you seeing? How is it manifesting in your day-to-day life, so we can help you function a little bit better right away? And you know, when you're dealing with military personnel, that's really what they want. They don't trust mental health folks a whole lot either, but they want to be able to function. And once you prove to them, okay, let's try this, and they start to function better, then they're much more likely to say, well, do you think it'll really help you dig into some of this stuff? Yeah, I do. Are you ready to do that work, you know?
Well, that, you know, it sounds like, you know, a common sense approach to me, and I think just by you articulating these things and people across the country listening to this, I guarantee you that there's going to be some people looking for therapists, and if that's the outcome, then we've done our job. Delilah,
exactly.
You have some other questions here?
Well, you know, going back to the missing persons families, I know, you know, just exactly what you've said, to get someone to be able to come through a day, I think is very important. It's a day-to-day kind of living that we do these days. But with families of missing persons, their trauma may change from day to day depending on what's happening in their case. And there again, you touched on the fear of the unknown, because we don't know what's happening from day to day within their cases.
Delilah, you just hit the nail on the head when it comes to dealing with missing people. And that's why, again, most folks who have a missing person don't trust mental health folks. Because they go in for a session, and what the mental health person wants to do is bring them to, and here's the word that I absolutely hate, closure. So
we don't like that either. We don't use that.
So I call it resolution. But what they start talking about is they start talking about the loved one in the past tense, and they start talking about the grieving process. Well, what that says to the family member is, you think my loved one's dead, and I don't. And I am not going to sit there and let you try to convince me my loved one's dead. The difference in this kind of field is that the trauma is not over. Mental health professionals have been trained in how to deal with PTSD. What's that first word? Post. It's over. It's done.
You're right.
when you've got a missing person, it's not over, and the trauma could continue for years and years. I know people who have had missing people missing for 30-some years and
right.
still believe that they're alive and still believe that they're out there, and who knows, they just may well be. But for them, the trauma hasn't ended. And so when a mental health person comes in and tries to work with post, and it's in the past tense, let's move forward, it's offensive and it doesn't satisfy the need. So, Delilah, you hit it right on the head. This is where mental health folks need to be trained on how do you deal with an ongoing trauma. And you know who really deals with that in an ongoing way are people who work with domestic violence, where the woman or man, whoever is being the victim, is going back into the environment. In other words, they're not ready to leave yet because the trauma is not over yet. Once they've grown enough in ego to be able to leave, now it's in the past tense, but if they're going to keep returning to the environment, the trauma is not over. So you're still working with an ongoing trauma. It's a very similar kind of thing. So what do you do in those cases? You work on what kind of skills do you need to make it through day to day? What do you need to put one foot in front of the other? What kinds of things can we come up with that will help you to be able to tolerate day after day? And one of the big tools, and again, this is not healthy for, if you talk to a mental health person, they tell you, oh my God, no, you can't do this. One of the things they have to do is be able to create two senses of future. All right, here comes Christmas. So here's the plan if he comes back, and here's the plan if he doesn't. Everything has a dual sense of future, which is not necessarily mentally healthy, but it's the only way they can put one foot in front of the other.
But it may be realistic, right?
Yes, exactly. And
would this same thing work well with working with domestic violence victims as well?
With domestic violence victims, in my opinion, and I'll tell you right up front, I don't have a lot of experience with domestic violence. I have a little bit. What I have found is reducing the fear is where you can be most helpful. If the victim is going to keep returning to the environment until you can strengthen that person to the point that they can walk out, if they're going to return, then you come up with what's your escape plan. What are the cues when he or she is escalating? When you see that escalation, what do you need to do? Instead of trying to talk them down, get out of the house. Can you keep yourself near a door? How can you get out of the house if you're on the second floor, et cetera, et cetera? Come up with the more you can empower that person to feel that they can be
the safety plan.
Out, the more, yeah, the safety plan, the more empowered they are, the quicker they start moving to a point of realizing, you know what, I handled that situation. I really don't need to return to it again. But I'm one of the ones that says a person has to be able to grow to the point of leaving. There are therapists out there that, you know, judge a person for keep returning. Of course they're returning. They have been victimized all their life about not having self-esteem, about not being worthy, and this is all you deserve, and et cetera. So until you can build some confidence and teach them about themselves, they're going to return to that environment. They've been abused most of their lives in many cases.
But I have a question when it comes to that. Some of the victims that we hear about quite often that we deal with, they come to that certain point and they get this false sense of confidence and I'm ready now, I'm going to walk out, and they divulge that to the perpetrator, to the abuser, and then it's curtains frequently, you know. So you don't divulge it to that person. It's great that they have become empowered. So what would you say about that scenario to prevent them from going to that step?
First of all, I think any, and I'm going to say woman just because it's usually women, though men can be victims of domestic violence as well. But any woman who is in that situation needs to be getting information from a center that handles domestic violence. She needs to be hearing from other women who have been through it. She needs to be getting information from people who know. And that's why I'm saying I'm not really a good resource. And if somebody comes to me who is in this situation, I make sure they're in a support group at a women's shelter, that they're getting information from people who have actually lived it, who can say to her, don't you dare say that to him because this is what will happen. If I were to say it, they'd say, yeah, he doesn't know what he's talking about, and I don't. But if they're hearing it from someone who's been victimized before, absolutely they'll listen to it. And that's why I think places that the women's shelters and the safe houses and all of those places are just such good resources for women who are trying to make that transition and trying to make a better life for themselves.
Right, and doing the EAA that we talk about and what Susan Murphy Milano does. Right.
I heard you talk about that at the beginning. What a great thing. Absolutely. Having that plan, talking to somebody about that plan, absolutely.
Well, great. We're glad you agree. Yeah, we're all here for the same purpose here. Go ahead.
Before we run out of time, one other area that I would like for you to quickly maybe address or answer a question for me. You know, with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, oftentimes there's repressed memory. Have you treated patients with this experience? And, you know, how do you process this coming out of the, you know, the memories to an adult who truly did not have any recollection of what had happened to them?
When a person, first of all, recognized that if a person came to me and said, I think I might have been abused, I'm not sure, what that's telling me is something's happening in their brain that if they were, it's starting to come up anyhow, and they're looking for guidance. And if they weren't, they just want to be sure that they weren't. So either way, we need to go back and figure that out. So it means that they're ready. If a person's not ready to do that work, you don't do it. You can do more harm than good. So you follow the client. And when the client says, you know what, I need to go back and remember. This is driving me nuts. It's worse not knowing. Okay. So there's different ways that you can do that. Now, I'm a certified clinical hypnotherapist, and that would be the way I would suggest, but if they're not comfortable with that, and of course I would explain what that is because most people don't know what clinical hypnotherapy is. It's not what you see on TV. I would describe what it is and would, you know, are they willing to try that or is there another way they might want to do it? There are a variety of ways of going back and tapping into your subconscious to finding out what are the memories that I've kind of repressed back there. And as a memory comes up, then you process it. You talk about, okay, what does this mean to you now? You've just seen this image in your head, and it's just made perfect sense to you. How is that affecting you as an adult? And do you see the ramifications it's had all your life? And now that you recognize where it's come from, can we make changes now that will help you live your life in a more productive way? The goal isn't to go back and see it. The goal is, will going back and seeing it help you to live in a more prosperous and a more healthy way now? The goal is, how is it manifesting today? So if we go back, it's not for just re-experiencing it. It's to go back and say, okay, now that we see that, how has that played out in your life all this time? And what can we do now that will help you change and be healthier in the way you're living life? And sometimes that means going back, and in hypnotherapy you can do this, going back and as the adult, going back and putting yourself in the scene with the child you and protecting the child you and learning that, yes, I can protect that child part of myself that was hurt. Now as an adult, I have the tools necessary to protect myself from that, and I'll stop there.
Wow, very, very interesting. And yeah, I think that people frequently get the wrong perception of, you know, what the focus is with a very complex issue that you brought up, Delilah. We have about 4 minutes left, and a couple of things. Can you define for us? What would be short-term versus long-term therapy? And, you know, I know with each individual person, it is individual in terms of what their needs may be, but, you know, a lot of times they may be apprehensive because they think they're going to be lying on a couch for a year or whatnot, and I know that's not the purpose. So can you talk about that a little bit?
It is the approach that the therapist takes. Now, I'm a licensed professional counselor. I'm an LPC. You right. also have psychologists, you have psychiatrists, you have social workers, you have a lot of different mental health folks who have mm-hmm. a different focus. Now, historically, psychiatry was based on the premise that if you're having some issues in life today, they probably started early in life, and you need to go back and reprocess that and work it forward, and that usually took a while. That was long-term therapy. Right. A lot of the therapy, because of managed care, insurance companies only giving clients, you know, 3 sessions or 8 sessions or 6 sessions, and only paying for that, mm-hmm. a lot of us have been forced into doing what's called brief therapy or solution-focused therapy. That is, okay, tell me how, yes, I hear you have this problem, but tell me what are the worst symptoms of it, and let's come up with ways that you can deal with those symptoms and change those symptoms, but we're not right. actually going to get to the core. We're just going to help you function on a day-to-day basis. Now, for mm-hmm. some folks, that's okay, and that's usually short-term therapy. But for some folks, when you're looking at self-destructive behavior, yes. you need more. You need longer therapy to get back into where did this come from and how did it serve you originally and what do we need to change in your perception
right.
of self.
And well, unfortunately, a lot of it's dictated by how good your insurance is too.
Absolutely.
You know, with
Absolutely.
Respect to that. And I hate to cut you off. We're getting really short here on time. I invite you to come back anytime you have an open opportunity, and I hope that you will keep in touch with us, Duane, because it's been a fascinating hour, and I do want to keep up with your activities in the future so that maybe we can come back and talk about something specifically, if you'd be willing, with your time schedule.
Absolutely, and thank you
great.
For having me.
Well, we've got that on tape now, you know. So anyway, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Just to close out here, please, everyone, do go to www.donnagore.com. I have a plethora of many different topics that I write about in terms of crime victimization, disability, and other topics, and they're always different, well-researched. I'm available for presentations. I'm also looking for other employment. We're going to have the new resume up very shortly. So please do contact me, contact Delilah. Please do check out imaginepublicity.com. There's many, many good professionals there that can be of assistance to you, as well as the Time's Up Forum. And I want to make sure to put in a final last plug. Please, if you're having difficulties with regard to intimate partner violence, contact SusanMurphyMilano.com. Do the EAA. And please do have a safe and a happy weekend, everyone. And I look forward to speaking with you next Saturday. Just to let you know really briefly, we're going to have Robin Moore on, and we're also having Chuck Elgin, Search and Rescue, and Sonar. We look forward to it. Thank you, everyone, and good night.